Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 34 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. We got a couple pictures from stars. There were two on their Instagram account and one that I remember on their Facebook account. The two on Instagram, there was one showing a lot of shoes. A lot of white and dirty shoes. But they look like a cross between Tom's shoes, which are, they're those, I'm sure everyone has seen those shoes. They're the ones that if you buy a pair, I think they donate a pair to somebody in a developing country. But they kind of look very homespun and somewhere between a cross of that shoe and a Ked. And they still exist. They still make them, which I find hilarious. They mentioned those shoes were for their dancing druids.
Yes.
We also got a shot of, it looks like...
oils?
Well, or some sort of, or maybe tinctures, or yeah. Some sort of, well, it says potions, a variety of potions and medicines. We're assuming...
Is that a horn?
Yeah, it looks like a
my
horn
goodness.
With something in it. I'm assuming it's Claire related. The only reason that I wouldn't jump to the Gaelis conclusion is because it does say medicines, and she was not known for her medicinals. I would say that that book looks incredibly...
new. Like 1950s?
Well, new and also really well modern. Printed. Like, it doesn't look like it's handwritten at all. And it's very shiny.
Yeah, but they had the printing press in the 18th century.
Yeah, but if it was really, like, her book and all the books that she was getting were all written, in, like, handwritten books.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll see. And on the Facebook account, there was a new shot of...
I don't know why this makes me laugh. It's just like, well, Dougal's standing there like,
he is, but the only thing that I noticed in this picture was I was looking for Calum's feet. Like, I spent the entire time, I was like, where are
his legs?
Feet?
Are they on that little
they're in the middle.
I mean, on the little
but it's
seat?
But it's confusing because it almost looks like his legs are, like, super wide, and then you look closer and his feet are not the... That's the chair. His feet are on the little box in the middle. And I literally stared at his little teeny tiny feet for the for probably 10 minutes. Anyway, it's a picture of the Mackenzie brothers. There's Dougal and Colm sitting in what I imagine is the Great Hall. We also got a new trailer for Sam's movie, Heart of Lightness.
And Laura Donnelly.
That's right, Jenny. She, isn't it?
And which I think is she's weird a to me. Role than he does.
I think she does too, but it's weird to me because aren't they kind of playing love interests?
I don't know, but that's it seemed like he was macking on her.
That's kind of what the trailer was leading me to believe, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be so weird. Well, I was watching the trailer, and I was like, this movie looks hecka funny.
It does.
Like, I was not expecting it to be funny.
Me either.
And I don't know why. With a name like Heart of Lightness, I should have thought it might be funny.
It's a play,
but it seemed like it was going to be very dour, maybe very serious, very dramatic. And this trailer, the way that it has been edited, is definitely not that way. I thought it looked really funny, and I would like to see it. We received a second Outlander's newsletter, official Outlander newsletter from Stars. This one seemed to be focused on discussing how they created the 1940s Scotland look that they have. Which is probably the one we've seen the most of.
Of course. They're not going to give too much away, except for, like, you can't hide the Highlands. So the Highlands are in tons of shots from locals or from people. But as far as the actual set that they're on or filming at, this is the one we've seen the most of, I think. Right?
I think so. I mean, it was the first one, for sure. It's the first one
40s
that
or the train station? Oh, well, the 40s, yeah.
The 40s in general. It was the first thing that they showed us. And... I think it's pretty amazing that they were able to find, I mean, I read this in the newsletter, that they were able to find, like, that little village that was straight out of the 40s in the bed and breakfast.
They didn't even have to do anything with it.
Like, they loved wallpaper. Like, old wallpaper with, like, stains and watermarks.
Well, that was the Falkirk, right?
I think so.
Well, they had the B&B.
Diana Gabaldon made Goodreads Reader's Picks of the 100 Books to Read in a Lifetime. She made number 55,
With
Outlander, the first book of the series, which I thought was pretty cool, because when I was looking at the list, like, the first 20 I would say, or maybe 16, are all books that we were forced to read in high school.
Mm-hmm. A lot of classics. All throughout, but especially the top 15, 20.
For sure. So to even be mentioned in the same pantheon as those was
But there were others that I will not mention that were before, and we're still kind of discussing the actual order, if this was the actual order of votes, or which reflected their popularity of choice. But there were a few modern stories, mm-hmm. also fiction, and, well, I guess these are fiction, modern stories in the last, 10 years that I may not have put before Outlander.
Here's the thing. I think that if you do this list again in a year, it will be different.
Absolutely.
And the reason is because a lot of the modern books that are on that, no, not even that, a lot of the modern books that are on that list were made into movies.
Very recently.
People were introduced to them
through the movies.
Through the movies, and then they're like, "Oh, these are great books."
Oh, Outlander's
going to
blow.
I think if they read you this list in a year, that Diana will be much higher on the list. So 55 is still
good.
Pretty amazing.
No,
it's like the entire history of books. They could pick anything, and I mean, books have been around for a very long time. I don't know if you know that. So Outlander Stars also put out a list of fan outlets / communities, which I think it was on their Facebook page at one point, but it looks like they took it down.
It was one of the tabs on the top of the page. Like, we have some tabs as well. Mm-hmm. It was one of their tabs, and it was working. At least it worked for myself and many, many people. Some people were having problems with it, but they also...
Most people have
They also gave... Yes. They also then provided a mobile link, which is a link, whether it's on your phone or on a desktop... or laptop, you can go straight to the hosted list, which is on the stars.com website. And that's great. We're just so happy it exists, because this is, as once the series appears or premieres, it's good for newbies, I think, because it gives, in case they're interested, it may be overwhelming to them. It gives them kind of it's not a complete list. It is still building up, and Stars says, we will say this again on their behalf, but they're not asking us to say this at all. If you have a fan group or fan site that is not represented, they do ask you to contact them. And that email address is on the bottom of the website.
It is.
And, so...
It says for a chance to be in the directory. Tell us about your fan group.
Yeah.
So, if you have a fan group, let them know.
But this is great. I don't remember ever having... neither did I look. I will say that. I have never looked before something came out to see if such a thing existed. But I have never heard of a network / production group putting out a list of fan directories for something that didn't exist yet.
Well, that's... everything
that's
about this
for
is
you.
That way. I mean, that's the nature of the Outlander experience.
Crazy!
So in book news, Diana has finished Moby.
I'm so happy for her and her sleep pattern
I'm so happy for us. We're much closer. I mean, the date that we get it in our hands hasn't changed. That has not changed one
iota.
But she
had a lot of stuff to do.
This is an important step toward getting those books into our hands.
Of course.
So, congratulations, Diana. We look forward to reading Moby. Anticipation. It's killing me. And lastly this week, and this was actually just from this morning,
mm-hmm.
for those of you who are not familiar with her, so there's a jewelry designer. Her name is Janet Kadsawan. Forgive me if I butchered it. I've been on kind of her radar. I've been kind of paying attention to her for the last
few
years.
She's been on your radar. I don't know if you've been on her radar.
Well, I should
Maybe
be.
She has.
Maybe.
That would be awesome.
I know. Janet, call me. Anyway, I love Janet. I'm just going to call her Janet. I love Janet because she designs jewelry based on book series.
Mm-hmm.
They're inspired by, different book series. And she's done them for...
Books and TVs. Some TV. Most
A lot of them
are
started
books.
As books.
Yeah.
Most of them are based on books. But she's done stuff for True Blood series.
Mm-hmm.
She's done stuff for the Morganville series. Like, she's doing stuff for 50 Shades.
Yes.
Like, she's doing jewelry. Like, if they've got a really awesome book series, A, she's probably read it, and B, she's thinking about making jewelry for it. And she's already talked to Diana previously about making the pearls.
Ellen's pearls.
She's already talked previously about...
And I think she published a sketch, didn't she?
I have to start the whole thing
okay,
over.
Okay, good.
She's already talked to Diana and gotten permission to create Ellen's pearls, which I would like to see. And I don't even really wear a lot of pearls, but, you know.
But for these, holy monkey.
I know, but they are my daughter's birthstone, pearls are, so that's very exciting for me. And that was the only thing that I really knew that she had in the work for Outlander. Like, she even has a little tab on her page that says, look at these collections, and one of them is Outlander, but it's empty right now. However, she released today that she is creating, it's called a Thistle Luckenbooth Charm Necklace. It's made in silver with 3 millimeters amethyst, and it is gorgeous. And I had to look up Luckenbooth charms.
Although some of the stuff, and I'm not saying the fan stuff, because I have not investigated. I've looked at a lot of her stuff. I had not, because I typically don't go buying a lot of jewelry, I had not investigated the price. But this one she had a link for. We're not going to discuss price, but oh my goodness, it is affordable.
Definitely.
Wow.
Well, here's the thing.
She also creates fine jewelry.
She does. And a lot of her stuff, I could never even think about buying, even though I would love to, because it's beautiful. But, there are quality pieces.
Oh, and she has, like, actress models model her stuff all the time.
Oh,
and wear her things.
Oh, for sure.
Celebrities totally wear her stuff.
Dude. She has, like, someone who works there, works for her, that she designed, like, her wedding rings, and I want them.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, I want them so bad. I was like, oh, I hope she makes that part of, like, a permanent collection so that somebody can purchase them someday. Anyway, I had to look up Luckenbooth charms because I did not know what they were from, but it's really, really pretty. Anyway, it's a Scottish heart-shaped brooch, often has a crown above one heart, and the Luckenbooth charm, the phrase comes from a Scottish word meaning lockable stall or workshop. But it's really, really pretty. You should check it out. Janet, like I said, call me. Let's do lunch.
Should we include this link in our... The link may change. That's the only thing.
We have linked to this particular piece on our Facebook page.
Yes, we linked it to her post, which has the link to it.
Right, and we'll put it in show notes as well. And in case you didn't know, show notes can always be found on our
blog.
On our blog.
Which is where, Summer?
www.outlanderpod.com.
We'd like to welcome back Arlen Donald to our podcast. And he has brought with him a very special guest as well. Arlen, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. And Arlen, could you introduce your guest to us?
I have brought along my lovely wife and all of her wool and 18th century knitting and fabric expertise.
Hi, I'm Diane.
Hello, welcome, Diane. Excellent to have you join us.
Hi.
So Arlen did talk a little bit about you and basic things like how you guys met and how you got him in. Well, wait, he had read Outlander when he was younger, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you did not introduce him to it, but you reintroduced him to it.
Yes. Well, when I met Arlen, he had a really different view of Outlander because he had encountered all of the lovely American and German tourists who came to Scotland looking for Jamie Fraser. And had a few hands up the kilt and a few other negative experiences. And he just really felt like Outlander had maybe turned Scotland into a bit of a theme park. So I, at that point, was already a ravenous fan and had read all the books that were available at that point. And I wouldn't accept it, that he didn't like it. I just knew that if he really read it, he would enjoy it. And so, yeah, one day we were looking for something to do, and we had always liked reading out loud to each other. And so he was laying on my bed on his stomach, and I sat on him and said, I'm going to read you the first chapter, and I'm not going to let you up until you listen. And so he did, and then he got up, and he was like, okay, well, maybe it's not so bad. Let's read the next one. And so he was hooked.
I think, well, even if he faked it at first.
Yeah, that's true.
To get you off
right?
Yeah, at least, not that we go around interviewing people about this at all, but I think that is the best story that I've ever heard, even though I've heard it like 4 times now. I think it's the best story ever about someone looping someone in to listen or read Outlander.
Oh, definitely the most aggressive I've heard. I know that I've, like, not really strong-armed any of my friends into reading it, but I've coerced them, I've handed them the book, I've cajoled them, I've talked them into it. I've never sat on anyone. But I may have to try that next time I come up against somebody who's definitely against
it. Exactly. I just couldn't believe that he didn't like it. I knew that he just needed to give it a chance.
Well, you know, like I said when I was on, I was, like, 17 when I first read it. I read it with a marked design of disliking it.
Yeah.
Which works very well when you're a teenager. And so... And Anne came along. All I could remember was that Jamie Fraser was absolutely perfect, and no one was really like that. You know, I'd met teenage American girls who convinced their parents to go to Scotland for a holiday, and were wandering around in Glasgow city centre complaining about the fact that there weren't enough men in kilts. So
that's actually another conversation, like maybe for, maybe not a whole show, but an interesting topic is what age is appropriate for the books. You say teens coming over, so that means they had already read it, and that's just a conversation I've heard a lot of people have in that, oh, my child is 13, I'd like, what do you guys think, is she ready for it? And I always kind of go, oh no, because it's a very individual thing, it's up to the parents, but it's a very difficult subject to, it's not one fix for all kind of thing.
Right, and I think the thing that makes it more of a book that really is best appreciated when you're an adult is the complicated relationship that Jamie and Claire have. I mean, there's a lot of subject matter that's a bit over the top, but really I think the thing that is hard is if you read it as a teenager, it's really hard to understand how anybody's relationship could be like that or just why it's all such a complicated, fraught mess, because the kind of relationships you have as a teenager, they just don't have any of that, and it's hard to understand a book series that's about a long-term serious marriage when you have no understanding of a serious relationship at all.
Well, I think it's like anything else. I think that you get something out of it different when you read it from different stages in your life.
Definitely.
I think if you were a teenager, you probably would get all of the highlights. I mean, not all teenagers. There's some teenagers that are very into historical accuracies and things like that, but you might get something different out. I mean, as I'm divorced, so I get something completely different out of the story now, having been in a relationship that
and had
you
know, a child.
Had, and have a child and
as
had an
mom,
ending.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that as you reach different stages in your life, maybe you find new things in the story that you didn't see before. You understand things from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And your emotional age as well. As you physically age and you hopefully gain life experience, and which goes in tandem with what you just said, but it's not just things you've gone through, but hopefully as you gain more wisdom and that experience, you handle things differently in your own life. And so when you come across it, on the rereads, when you come across so much more of the relationship, it's just find someone who has not read it and who is open-minded. Have them keep a journal as they read it the first time. The first time through all the books. And then maybe wait 2 or 3 years. Have them revisit it. I am very curious because we all have these experiences, but I've never documented any of mine.
You know, actually, I do. I have all of my copies of the books have little pencil notes in the margins, and I've been rereading in preparation for the newest book. And it's been really interesting to me to go back and see all of the notes I made to myself about what bugged me or what I thought was really cool. And I definitely, I've read the series a lot of times, but I definitely feel like I'm at a different place in my life and different things are really sticking with me this time. So, yeah, I used to do that with a lot of my books when I was younger. I'd just write in my books, and I don't really do it as much now, but it's kind of neat to have that commentary there.
That's pretty cool. I've never heard. I know of people who do that, and especially in the academic setting, of course. You're almost expected to.
Yes.
That's really cool. That would be a nice, almost like a, you know, when that gets handed down to the next generation or to the next people, that's like a time capsule or something.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's been kind of fun watching Dan reread some of the ones that we haven't had a chance to read in a few years because we were, you know, just catching up on whichever book came before the one that was about to come out. And she was rereading Dragonfly and Amber, and she was sitting at the dinner table, and she just kept blurting out, oh my God, I forgot how much of an idiot Claire was. I didn't think she was an idiot last time around.
Yeah. The last time I read that one, I was totally on Claire's side, really mad at Jamie's behavior most of the book. And this time I'm like, wow, Claire was totally as much to blame as Jamie was for the stuff that goes on. And I just, it never occurred to me before because it's been years since I read that one.
Yeah, I always surprise myself on a reread. I mean, every single time. It's not just the stuff you remember or you forgot. I guess that's it. It's how I react to the stuff that I did remember again. I mean, I think my reactions also surprise me because I know what happens. I know the facts of the book, but then you get in there and you say, oh my gosh, that's right. Oh, there was this little twist or this little one. And you just start not hating, but you have those strong feelings come up and you're at the dinner table and you make remarks like you did. And then I'm not going to talk about Dragonfly Number quite yet. That's for hopefully a season 2. But this is a theme, I think, that goes through anyone's reread, especially of more than one or two books. Having gotten through to Echo, even if you've only read three or four, and then you go back and you start at the beginning, with the first hint at another time traveler, and that we've already come to this in Outlander, so we can talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. The first hint is when we see Galus's smallpox vaccination scar.
Right.
And I don't know, it hit, obviously now it doesn't surprise me, but I remember the first time reading Outlander, I was like, what the what? There's more? Because I don't know why I had this closed mind about there was no way for it to be anyone other than Claire. So, you know, you develop and you find out, oh, it kind of opens your mind. It's like, oh my gosh, there's more of them. What could go on? Because that opens so many other possibilities. And then you go on to DIA and it's like, you see these little things and you see someone, you recognize a name that used to be on someone's grimoire and you see that, you know, all these things and you start wondering, oh, was this person that? And then now I'm, especially on a reread, I am much more suspicious of certain characters, even ones that aren't that maybe blatantly potentially travelers.
Well, I don't know. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that was it.
Just was going to say, I don't know if you remember hearing about it. It was in the news a couple of years ago. Someone did a study related to Harry Potter books and found that people enjoyed the series more when they knew what was going to happen because they could pay attention to those little details. So they had groups of people, and some of them, they told them, okay, this is the story, and here's what happens at the end, and then read the story. And then they had another group of people where they just told them nothing, and the people who knew what was going to happen rated the story far higher in terms of their enjoyment because they weren't, like, skimming and flipping pages and trying to get to the end. They could just kind of sit back and watch what was happening and take it in. So, yeah.
That's interesting. I would hate that.
I thought the exact same thing. And, you know, there are people who, I mean, I've read books where they do that. Like, I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head, but there are books, you know, where they say on the first page, this is a book about how I died. And then you read the entire book about how that happened.
Was it that how The Lovely Bones started?
Yes, that's the one. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a great book.
How about the movie Tangled, where Eugene starts out
I was like, they don't say that. Oh, he does.
That's
true.
Yes.
And so we have, but you forget about it. He says it in the first, like, 2 seconds of the movie, and you forget about it, and then the end happens, and you're like, what?
They changed Rapunzel on us.
I feel like a lot of people, you know, do say, well, I wouldn't like that. I wouldn't like knowing what happens before I read the book. And I would be one of them. But then, you know, you think about, like, I definitely grew up in the old-fashioned Scottish storytelling tradition. And almost every time, everyone had their favourite story that they wanted to hear over and over and over again. Even when they got offered a new story that they'd never heard, they wanted to hear the one where they already knew everything that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's definitely a sign of, like, you get that anticipation of knowing what's coming, but getting to hear all of those details again really is just pleasurable.
I guess so, considering how many times we've all reread the book.
Yeah.
My daughter's like that, though, at bedtime. She wants the same story, and if you tell it wrong, she'll tell you. She's like, you're telling it wrong!
Come on, Mom.
You know, it has, I mean, definitely children, obviously, but to me, it's maybe not literally located on chromosome number 92A or whatever, but it has, to me, this is as deep as our bones and as deep as our DNA, as deep as our species, because the oral tradition predates anything we've ever had.
Definitely.
And that is how information was handed down, stories kept, secrets kept, recipes, everything. And I could imagine, you know, when that's all you have, and it's a huge, it's very rich, but when that's what you have and that's what our species kind of quote-unquote, grows up with, then it makes perfect sense what you're saying. It just, to me, that mirrors it.
Yeah.
There was an anthropologist who came out with a book a few years ago that was about how humans are the storytelling animal, that's what the one thing that separates us from other species is that we tell each other stories about things that not only have never happened, but could never happen. We just love doing that to each other, and that it's clearly something that's really important to our development as a species.
I like that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's more to it.
Oh, yeah.
No, but that's very true. I mean,
no.
And then, of course, wait until we crack the dolphin code, and we'll find out that they're telling stories.
I would not be a bit surprised.
Besides being linked with Arlen, and besides loving the books, what are some other interests/abilities that you have that you'd like to share with us today?
Well, The main thing I thought you guys would be interested in hearing about is the fiber industry, wool industry in Scotland. A little later on in the series, we get a taste of Jamie's knitting abilities, but there are a lot of references, even in Outlander, to the wonderful properties of Jamie's plaid keeping Claire warm and the sheep industry. And it's been a particular area of interest to me. I've been a knitter since I was a little kid, and I learned to spin about 10 years ago and have kind of gradually gotten into that world. In 2007, I had a historical reenactor approach me through my blog and say, I'm looking for someone to make 18th century Scottish bonnets, and I can't find anyone who will do it the way they are really supposed to be done. And so I started researching and started making them for reenactors, and being married to a Scotsman, I would be pretty useless if I didn't make sure he had kilt hose. So then I got into knitting kilt hose, and once in a while I get to make something for myself, but it's really kind of subsumed me. And so I design knitting patterns, and I love learning about the history of that industry. And I think that the field of experimental archaeology has really been expanding. And on the basis that you learn a lot about how things were done in historical times by doing it yourself. And so learning things like how to spin wool, how different types of wool behaved, Shetland fleece versus St. Kilda fleece. Learning about those properties really teaches you a lot about what life would have been like for these people. So it's become a complete crazy addiction for me, and there's just balls of yarn and fluff all over our house, but really makes me happy. So yeah.
Do you actually spin your own, like a spinning wheel?
I do. I have a couple of spinning wheels. One was a gift, and it's an antique, and it's lovely. I've spun yarn on it before. It's over 100 years old, and it's just this tiny little style of wheel that was developed for people who are on the road or traveling a lot, and it's small enough that you can fit it in your covered wagon or whatever. And I also own a larger spinning wheel that was a rescue from Craigslist and was not very well loved by its former owner. But yeah, I actually just finished a project, my very first project, where I went from the raw fleece right off the sheep to spinning it into wool, and I have enough yarn spun now to make a sweater. And I haven't started the sweater yet, but I wanted to do the whole process from sheep to finished garment. So it's been a really interesting process, and it's just been such an eye-opener about how much manual labor is needed to keep people clothed pre-industry. It's been a really interesting process, and, you know, like I said, it just gives you so much respect for the way, for the value of clothing to these people. And if you look at history of these kinds of things, you'll see that a lot of people who were arrested for stealing were arrested for stealing clothes in the 18th century because they were so expensive and so hard to come by. There's a great book out there called Women's Work, The First 20,000 Years, that's about the history of spinning and weaving and knitting. And one of the things it talks about is how historically, throughout human history, people have spent twice as much time making clothing as they have producing food for themselves, even including agriculture and animal husbandry. Making clothing before the Industrial Revolution was a huge time suck, and it really makes you see how it could be such a valuable thing. A piece of tartan is a really valuable item for someone to have when you think about, you know, if you have a 5-yard kilt, that's probably 2 sheep fleeces. And if you can only afford to keep half a dozen, you know, the math is very not in poor people's favor. So in one of my future projects, I hope to weave enough tartan for a kilt for Arlen. I have recently acquired a giant over-the-top loom. So someday I will spin and weave a kilt for Arlen, but it's going to be a ways down the road.
That like would like be an old-style kilt?
I don't know.
Or like the new pleated belted one.
Which would you prefer, Arlen?
Probably a full bore.
The big one?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you know, and it's just, to give you an idea of the scale, I started the project with the sweater 2 years ago. And hand washing and combing all of the yarn and spinning all the yarn. And granted, I worked on other things during that time and had a life during that time, but it's really, it's a lot of hours. And you can see how, why every single person in Scotland would have known how to spin and known how to knit, and you would pretty much constantly have been doing one of those activities if you wanted to be able to keep yourself warm, especially in a place where it's wet and cold, and it's really important to, you know, where wool is something that is warm when it's wet, unlike other fibers. The dependence on the sheep was something that really continued pretty much from prehistory into modern times in Scotland. You know, the wool industry is still really important in the UK.
I think I read an article where the, aside from tartans, wool in general is so Scottish wool, and maybe there are, obviously there are different types of the Scottish wool in different areas and regions and islands.
Mm-hmm.
Scottish wool is so sought after that it's coveted even as far away as in Japan.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, and there are some breeds of sheep specific to Scotland that only survive and do well in clement weather. It's very similar to cashmere goats, for example. You can't keep a cashmere goat where we live in Idaho because it doesn't get cold enough, and so they won't get that thick coat. Uh-huh. They won't grow enough wool to make it worthwhile. Before industrialization, Shetland wool was like the most sought after wool because it's incredibly soft and fine. And it wasn't until later in the 18th and 19th centuries that that other breeds like the Merino and things that are more common started to become more popular. But Shetland wool has a history of being very sought after. And there are other breeds of sheep unique to Scotland that have just fantastic fleeces and are not as well known. One of my favorites is the North Ronaldsey sheep. North Ronaldsey is an island in the Hebrides, and it is a breed of sheep that lives on seaweed because when farmers were farming the island in the late 18th century, land became more and more of a premium and people were getting given smaller and smaller portions, and they didn't have room for the sheep to graze on the fields because they needed to grow their own food, and the sheep gradually got pushed back and pushed back until all they had was the beach. And so these sheep live on the beaches and eat seaweed, and they're now to the point where they can't survive on grass. They only can survive off of seaweed, and their wool is incredibly fine and lovely to work with, and there are efforts going on in the UK to preserve that and other rare Scottish breeds. The St. Kilda sheep, which was left on the island of St. Kilda by the Vikings, is another one that's very popular, and their wool is very nice. Soy has its own breed of sheep. So there are a lot of ones specific to Scotland, but one of the things that they all have in common is that they are very old breeds. They're mostly descended from sheep either brought over by the Celts or the Vikings, and they have a very fine, soft coat, but which needs a lot more processing than some of the high-producing, high-yielding, industrialized breeds of sheep. So it's interesting stuff. The history of the whole country of Scotland can really be told by its sheep.
Well, and, you know, culturally, wool production was such a big thing that, you know, you have things like, you have walking songs for when you're walking wool, for example, if you're making tweed, it's one of the processing parts that's done, and people would sing songs to the rhythm so that they could kind of keep themselves going, and it was a communal effort. You'd have, you know, four or five people on either side, and they would all be singing together, and they would have parts, you know, left hand sings this side, right hand sings this part of the song, and, you know, really intricate stuff like that. And then we have, you know, things like, and there's a particular step dance that is based on the actual process of the loom that came in with industrialization, which is a wonderful dance to watch. And you stamp as you're doing the dance, so it kind of sounds like the loom mechanisms, and everyone's sort of weaving in and out and moving up and down like the bobbins would. And it's a really fun dance to do, but it's really interesting to watch as well. So we have all of these things that are completely different areas of the cultural prospect, like singing and dancing, that still have wool involved in them.
So it sounds like the wool, and thus the sheep, enter into every facet of the history of Scotland.
Yeah, well, and one of the primary reasons for that is because the breeds that are kept and that are native to Scotland are able to survive off of poor food and bad weather. If you look at the Shetland, they live, you know, they're native to the Shetland Islands, where there's wind and very little vegetation and very little shelter. The St. Kilda sheep was actually thought to be gone for a long time because they were left on this island by, like I said, by retreating Vikings, and the island was uninhabited for like a century. And no one knew there were sheep living on this island, and they were perfectly content to stay there and hang out and feed themselves. So these are very hardy animals, and when you think about the fact that there wasn't a lot of good arable land, and what was there was really needed for growing food, so the sheep, they had to have sheep that could fatten up and raise lambs and produce fleece on heather and gorse prickles, and they were like the primary food source for these Highlanders and also the primary source of clothing. And you can see why there is so much folklore about, you know, fairies stealing sheep fleeces and the pixies coming and hiding people's sheep. And because it was so, it was the difference between life and death for a lot of people for a long time in a lot of Scotland. So.
Well, and you know, the fabric itself, and you know, I can certainly attest to the fact that it doesn't matter how much wind and rain there is, and there's a lot in Scotland, wool will keep you warm the whole way through. And I was posting those pictures on Twitter from when I climbed Ben Nevis, and it started out as a lovely sunny morning, and then right as we're going along the arête, this just really incredibly thick fog rolled in. And it was basically, you couldn't see down either side of the arête, which was kind of a terrifying prospect. And there, you know, most of the group that I was with had on Gore-Tex and, you know, four or five layers of windbreakers. And I just had my kilt and kilt hose and a wool sweater and a cotton t-shirt under that. And I actually, halfway through, I had to take off the, you know, really lightweight raincoat that I had on because I was getting too hot. And with the wool, you know, it gets wet, but it stays warm, and it's completely breathable. And we even had, we were in Boston for Hanukkah last year, and I was wearing one of the Scottish bonnets that Dan makes. And we got lost walking home after the transit had closed, and we ended up walking for hours in a pouring rainstorm in Boston. And we got home, and even my waxed jacket had soaked through all the seams, but my head was completely dry underneath the bonnet. So it's definitely a very useful fabric for the conditions in Scotland. And, I mean, you see that there's so many mentions in Outlander of, you know, staying warm with Jamie's plaid or having a wool bonnet on in the rain. Certainly as you get into the books after Outlander, there's a lot more mention of just how valuable the fabrics are and how much they're used for.
And it's nice to see it getting more respect now as a material. For a while, wool had a really bad reputation of being scratchy and smelly, and badly processed wool can be, but the good stuff is amazing. And yeah, it can hold up to 30% of its weight in water before it feels wet at all. It's incredibly warm. It's flame retardant. It's antimicrobial. It's amazing stuff. And it's really, wool is really responsible for the Scottish people being the way they are. And so you can, you know, I have a lot of respect for that. And I've really enjoyed getting to study and learn more about it. The British wool industry, even after the time of Outlander, Britain for a long time was the exporter of wool to the world. And inventions like the spinning jenny and the weaving machine, those came out of Lanarkshire. Scotland was a huge hub for even industrialized wool production for a long time. And it wasn't really until the late 19th century that other parts of the world, South America and New England, started to come to the forefront. So It's still a major draw for Scotland. One of the first vacations Arlen and I ever went on was to the Scottish Wool Centre in Aberfeldy. Aberfoyle. And it's an amazing place, and they do sort of sheepdog demonstrations, and they have fiber and sweaters and things for sale, and it's this entire place dedicated to how wool has influenced and supported the Scottish people. And let's not forget, haggis, you know. This is also a major food source for these people, and a fleece could clothe one person, basically, and if you had that, and then you had their lamb, and be okay. Unfortunately, then, other breeds of sheep came in and got a really bad reputation after the Highland Clearances, which are a little later in our history. The lairds, who often lived in London, kicked all their tenants off of their land and instead decided to start raising these big industrialized breeds of sheep, like blackfaces and cheviots, which you can find songs from the 18th century about how these horrible beasts have taken us off of our land. And one of the things I studied in college, I did a paper on when I was living in Scotland, on the economics of the Highland Clearances and the math that these landowners did where that the sheep were worth more than the tenant farmers they had on their land. So it's also a very deep betrayal when you think about it from that point of view, that these sheep kept the Highlanders alive for generations, and then the sheep ended up being the reason that they lost their lands and ended up having to leave Scotland. So it's an interesting but very complicated history.
Absolutely. I think that's a good way to put it. It's interesting, complicated, and like any history of any place, it has its high points and tragedy. And that, I guess the wool would be one of the surviving success stories because it's still going strong.
Definitely. You can't walk down the Royal Mile for 10 minutes without seeing someone trying to sell you a sweater. You know? It's great that it's come back into play, and now the cottage industries in Scotland are starting to revive. There are people out there spinning and knitting for a living, and there are wool shops popping up and people learning how to do these things, these crafts that were sort of lost after World War II, and then we had a few generations who thought that, you know, that's peasant work, that's not interesting. Wool sweaters are things with tight necks, and they're itchy, and they're horrible. And now, you know, our generation is starting to realize that there's a lot of intrinsic value to these things and that you learn a lot about the world and you learn a lot of respect for everything, agriculture, the clothes you wear, the work of your hands, by actually taking the time to do the process yourself. And then you also get spoiled, like I have, and you realize it's just nicer. I like wearing hand-knit wool socks, and now I'm spoiled and I don't like the cotton socks from Walmart. I want what I want, so.
Well, taking a small detour, a short detour away from wool, although it's definitely still involved, Arlen, we wanted to chat with you. You provided us with a very interesting document, and we just wanted to maybe take a few minutes to chat with you about some of the myths or misconceptions about the kilt.
You know, this has become like the one really big pet peeve I have in life. I'm trying hard to get better, but there are days.
It's okay. It sounds great when you're not.
We love when he gets grumpy. He's such a good curmudgeon. Adorable.
Exactly. We need this. Don't change.
The other day I got into work and I was almost in an apoplectic rage. And it's what it is there are a lot of myths that have grown up around the kilt. And some of them are, you can kind of understand where the idea came from and why it would be believable. And some of them are wildly inaccurate, and I don't know why anyone would believe it. And, you know, one of the main ones that I have encountered since I moved to America is the idea that the kilt was an ancient Celtic / Norse / Japanese garment that the Scots were the only ones who continued to wear it, but really it had existed everywhere else in the world before then somehow. And I even had one person tell me that in the tartan fabric there are ancient Celtic writings, which if you're a modern-day druid, you're able to read. I know a number of modern-day druids, and they all agree that's nonsense. But, you know, the simple fact of the matter is we have historical evidence that the kilt did not appear anywhere in the world until the Highlands of Scotland in the 1500s. And one of the very earliest sources we have for the kilt being a particularly Scottish garment is actually an Irish source. And a lot of people do say that the kilt was originally Irish. But there is this Irish source where they're writing about the outlandish garb of these Hebridean warriors who've come over to help fight in one of the Irish wars, and how they wear these plaid kilts and wrap them all about themselves and how strange they look, and that's how you can tell they're Scottish, is because that's the way they dress and no one else dresses like that. So that's one of the ones that's always been a thorn in my side. And the main other one is the idea that the great kilt, the Philivore, was originally 9 yards or more long, and you had to lay it out on your floor and roll around in it and put a belt around it to get dressed. And people will often tie onto this the idea of the kilt being the whole 9 yards, and that's where that phrase came from. And unfortunately, that phrase originated in America not that long ago. And really,
well, then you're welcome.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with kilts, but I mean, from a simple practical standpoint, 9 yards of fabric, that's about 40 feet. And I cannot imagine any cotter in the Highlands with a house big enough that he could arrange that on his floor and get dressed in the morning, let alone trying to do that outside on a cold, wet day. You know, you wouldn't want to be laying your clothes on the ground and carefully pleating it all up. We actually do have historical examples of the great kilt that are still surviving, and they were at most 5 yards long, and that was for a particularly rotund gentleman. And we have historical evidence through paintings and a couple of surviving examples where it's made kind of clear that very likely would have had a drawstring, and you would have had loops or holes in the fabric where you put a belt or a ribbon or some such through, and you would just quickly tie that around your waist and then arrange the folds in front of you, your two aprons, and put your belt on, and you're ready to go. And actually, I made a video some time ago, and I need to remake it with better production values, which basically had a timer on it of how fast it took you to get dressed in the mornings if you were wearing that style of great kilt. And it didn't take any longer than putting on a modern-day kilt or putting on, you know, just everyday jeans and a T-shirt, because it's such a fast way to do it. You just make a couple of quick knots, and you're ready to go. And so, just logically, it makes much more sense to assume our Scottish ancestors actually had a brain and didn't want to spend 45 minutes getting dressed in the morning.
Well, I'm sure there was a lot of variation as well. You know, I think, obviously, if you've done it a few times, it would probably get quicker with effort. But I would assume that maybe some people had drawstrings, and maybe some people had belts, and maybe some people didn't, or maybe their belt loops came off. But, you know, if you're wearing a piece of fabric, there's obviously a lot of ways to make it work and a lot of ways to make it easier. And yes, I don't think that the Scots were necessarily an intrinsically impractical people who wore clothing that didn't make any sense and was hard to wear.
Yeah.
But I've also seen people get into a great kilt pretty darn quick, with or without belt loops. So I was reading, skimming over stuff last night, and there was a passage, I can't remember where in Outlander, where Claire was talking about that and the laying out the kilt and the pleating it up, and that she was really impressed because Jamie was so good at it that he could do it standing up. And I thought, oh yeah, well, so obviously not everybody had to roll around on the ground, and you know, you'd be amazed at how hard it would be to find a flat spot big enough anywhere in Scotland to do that on.
Yeah.
Well, and it's the variations. I mean, just go to any toga party and you'll see that there are so many ways to wrap a piece of fabric around a person.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of cultures independently came up with things very similar. I mean, if you look at the uniforms that the traditional Greek army wear, they wear a pleated kilt that's very darn similar. It just happens to not be made out of wool. Because, yeah, eventually you wrap something around your hips and you hide your bum with it, and then you have a kilt. So
they're just bum hiders.
I don't know why they think they need to do that.
Well, I think it would be very distracting. Bum hanging out.
And chilly, probably.
Oh, and chilly. I thought, sorry. Okay. Chapter 28, Read Along. Kisses and Drawers. I love this title. It's very sweet and seemingly innocent, kind of. In this chapter, the beginning, they are becoming part of the running of the estate. They're starting to kind of find their place now. Mm-hmm. And Claire begins to visit with the tenants' cottages and taking them food or medicines and asking them basically how can she help them.
Yeah.
And at Lallybroch, at their house, she helps where she can, but I guess most of her time is spent in the gardens. There's like a medicinal garden, a large garden that they use for the kitchen, and then a small, maybe not botanical garden, but a small area.
Herb garden, kind of.
Yeah, yeah, an herb garden. And also there's an area with the, they talk about all the last of the summer's roses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jamie also dove into it, and Diana uses the phrase, making up for lost time.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets, especially after you've read the series, read the books a number of times, or even just once, you go back and it's, because you know what's coming and you know what's going to happen, and this phrase kind of tweaks my heart a little bit after having read it the first time, because you know that he's trying to make up for lost.
The story of this, I mean, the through plot of this whole series, start to finish, is about lost time.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, yeah, hello.
For everyone. Like, oy.
I mean, there's not a single character that I could think of that hasn't lost something or lost two times something, you know, wasted time or something that's come up that would not be appropriate to put with.
I think, too, one of the defining things about Jamie's character is that he is, at heart, such a quiet person that despite his sort of calling to be the laird and despite being involved in so many complicated things, all he really wants to do is go home and smell the flowers. And you can really hear in the way he talks that he loves Lallybroch and he wishes he could just be there forever. And later in the series, other places, it's the same thing. He's constantly being pulled into these complicated situations, and really all he wants to do is just have a little peace to be at home with his family and get to do the things that give him pleasure. And so there's always that sort of wistfulness about him and about the books in general, because I think that's something you can identify with wherever you are, that we all wish we had more of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. How much time have they really had, or do they end up really having together, where they have like a little happy family farm setting, whether it's in Scotland or elsewhere, mm-hmm. and there are moments of it, but as soon as they have like a little bit of a white picket fence going on, someone gets kidnapped or someone gets, or something goes and rocks their world, and you're just like, oh no, because, I mean, it makes the story,
but I think they have to have times like this, even if they're brief, just so that the characters remember what they're fighting for, and remember what they want and what they're striving for, and why it makes it worth it, all of the things that they do to get there.
Well, I've always found the chapter to be particularly melancholy because, you know, Jamie, he was raised to this, and he considers this is his duty given to him by God to care for these people. You know, that's his job in life, is to care for his people. And he knows, and we've seen throughout the rest of the book, he can go off, he can do, you know, whatever he wants and survive and be fine, but this is what he truly loves, and he believes this is what he's meant to do. But it's made clear in this chapter that they know they're going to have to leave soon. They know they only have this limited period of time here. And then it's on to the next battle. It's on to trying to find a way to clear Jamie's name so he can do his job. And so it's very sad. And, you know, with the other memories and life experiences they discuss in the chapter, and, you know, his strong memories of his father and things like that, It's really interesting to see how they're sad, and the way they combat it is just trying to make up in the most time they can.
Well, and I don't know. It's funny. Diana has written before in her blog about how, you know, how close she feels to these characters and how much she loves them, but how you really only get to see what they're like when you put them in these really hard situations, and she keeps coming up with really, really hard ones for them to go up against, and it's a shame that, I mean, it would be a really boring book if it was just like Jamie and Claire got married, and then they went to Lallybroch, and they all lived happily ever after. Like, it wouldn't be much of a book, but at the same time, I think we're all rooting for them, and we just want them to get to have those things that they want, because we like them. They're very likable, and they're on our side. We feel like we're on their side.
And one of the other things, it wasn't a quote, it is referencing something that Claire mentions, or at least that we see through Claire. They know they have to leave again, but they want to make sure that the place is running well while they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that's a little poignant, but you juxtapose that with Claire feels that she's come home at last. And that actually brings a little bit of a tear to your eye, because they know they have to go soon. They have to leave before the snow comes. They're trying to do whatever they can. And at the same time, Jamie's trying to make up for lost time. You know they're gutted. You know they're... Now, part of Claire feeling like she's come home is that she's made this decision. She now knows she's staying with Jamie. Mm-hmm. And now that they're at his ancestral home, it's like the pieces of the puzzle, for now, she knows they can't last. She knows they can't stay. But this is the first time since she's come through the stones that she has felt any kind of home.
Yeah, and it's more powerful, I think, because she never really had one before Jamie. You know?
Exactly.
She, even a child, was just...
Stop it, girl.
Yeah.
That particular bit is kind of poignant for me. Just the idea of having home be a particular person. I actually had a moment when Dan and I were first dating, and she was in college in Aberdeen and I was living back home in Glasgow, and so we're at the bus stop saying one of our usual goodbyes, and I was giving her a hug, and I meant to say, you know, it's okay, I'll be back soon, but what came out of my mouth was, it's okay, I'll be home soon. Mm-hmm. And that actually, like, when I said it, I felt really, really embarrassed, but also it kind of made sense. I was like, oh yeah, that's what that is. And so that moment for me is something that I can really understand.
It's a very, you know, when I go to take notes, and I'm reading something, that I make sure I take hopefully decent notes. And yes, I want to feel the feelings and go through it so I know we can have a good chat. We've gotten through one paragraph of notes because there's so much there.
Yeah.
Jamie mentions that he plans to ride out and see a horse for sale. But Jenny mentions that there had been some English patrols out and about, And then Ian pipes in that the mill wheel had gotten stuck and asks Jamie to have a look at it, and thus sets forth the course for this chapter. And Jamie asks Claire, I love it when he does this. It's very silly, but I had to mark it down. Jamie asks Claire to come with him and bring her wee basket. And the basket is like probably half Claire's size. So. it's a big basket and it's got a lot of stuff in it. And speaking with Ian, Claire mentions that they'll have to be leaving well before the snow comes. She relays that Jamie decided their best chance of their survival would be to go to Beaulieu and to the scene of Clan Fraser, where his grandfather lives, the Lord Lovett.
The castle's Beaulieu.
Oh, Beaulieu. See, I'm thinking, oh, that's right. It's Beaulieu, that's right. I'm thinking of the etymology. The etymology is French of Beaulieu or Beaulieu, beautiful place. And Beaulieu is actually how it's pronounced correctly today.
I really like to pronounce French wrong in Scotland.
But it's not French anymore. It's Scottish. So they want to go find out to see if there's any way they can get some support from that corner. As they're making their way out to the mill pond, or the mill, Jamie mentions that a quarter day is coming up and asks her if her gown is ready or her dress. And I did have to look that up because my first thought with a quarter day was, okay, four times a year, it must be the solstices and equinoxes. Like, why would they celebrate those? That sounds a little strong. Catholic wouldn't necessarily celebrate those days. Quarter days are days which rents were due and servants were hired, and they fell on four religious festivals that were 3 months apart, hence quarter days, but that these days themselves were close to, and I'm guessing, depending on the year, maybe even on, the equinoxes and solstices.
Yeah.
And would that include, like, the Candlemas and the Michaelmas?
Well, see, what I had always read was that the quarter days fell between the equinoxes and solstices, so that the traditional dates would be Candlemas is February, beginning of February, Beltane is beginning of May, Samhain is halfway between the fall equinox and the winter solstice, you know, that's Halloween, and then, so you have these cycles, and you hear, I don't remember if it's in this one or if it's in later books, but they talk about the quarters and the cross quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the quarter days are the ones that fall in between, but yeah, they still, those holidays, you know, Scottish people being very practical, they just sort of recycled the pagan holidays and tacked new things on, and yeah, they were very convenient times for everyone to get together and pay their rent and hire new people, and also to share news and have a little market, and that process continued well into the 19th century, having the quarter day hiring. You can see photos of quarter day fairs in different places, even after it was a quarter day to hire people to work in a factory instead of a quarter day to hire people to work in your house or on your farm.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's kind of cool.
You know, you mentioned it felt a little bit strange for, you know, these strong Catholics to maybe have relationships with those pagan festivals. And I have to say there are very few things you will find in the world more superstitious than a Scot.
It's so true.
There's absolutely nothing in a Scot's life that causes them to think, I'm a very strong Catholic or Protestant, and therefore I will stop believing in the fairies coming to kidnap my children. It's not going to happen.
So they have to cover all their bases.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and to see that, like when they were at Leoch and listening to the stories about that lady getting taken away by the fairies, where they throw the iron blade, but also ask Jesus and Mary and Joseph to come. Like, it was just very convenient to sort of add those things together and come up with that interesting Celtic spirituality that there are still a lot of people that adhere to that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Arlen is incredibly superstitious, and I try not to tease him too much about it or give him too much of a hard time, but really, it's completely distracting, especially to, like, a pragmatic, realistic person like me, so.
You'll find that a lot with a lot of religions, not just with people, that a lot of things coincide very coincidentally with pagan holidays.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like everyone tries to, the easiest way to get somebody to join your new religion is to kind of make it coincide with their religion, so they kind of think they're all working together. And, I mean, if you look at, like, Easter, all of the, like, the Christians and Catholics, you know, they all believe in, you know, the Jesus and the rising and everything like that, but then there's this Easter bunny.
Yeah, the bunnies and the eggs,
Place and eggs. But, I mean, those all go back to, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, to pagan rituals and things.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Christians, the Catholics in the UK certainly weren't the first ones to do that. You know, if you look at Bath in England, the Romans built a temple there, and because they knew that this was already a spot venerated by the people who lived there at that time, they had a sort of water deity there, and so the Romans built a Roman temple there and sort of tacked it on to this goddess Aquae Solis, who was sort of a combination of the Roman Aquae and the Brythonic Sulis, because it was easier, and then everybody sort of agreed, and it was just sort of a blending of those two cultures. So actually that's a tactic that the Romans used a lot of places, but it worked really well in Britain because both sides sort of agreed on.
I know their religions are different, definitely from polytheistic to monotheistic, but because originally, right, the Roman Catholic Church, there is that Romanish to it, that it came straight out of the Roman Empire.
Yes.
So you can see that, well, at least when it was under Constantine, made the religion of the realm under Constantine. Yeah, that does not surprise me at all. I mean, it makes perfect sense that not just would the Romans in Brythonic Britain be doing this, but that practice, which started, and I'm sure the Romans weren't the only ones ever, only conquering people to do something similar, but yes, that started with the Romans, and then where the Romans had already been, and then when it became a Catholic empire, then it was tacked onto that. So whatever had been Roman became Christian. So now you have Christian after Roman after whatever gods came before that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, religion kind of naturally takes on the personality of where it is being right now. So, I mean, you hear Presbyterian here, and it's a completely different thing from what you think of in Scotland. In Scotland, we think of the Free Presbyterian Church, which is mainly in the Highlands and Islands now. And you're not allowed to do anything. I went to school, I had some friends who were in the Free Presbyterian Church, and most people in Scotland refer to them as the Wee Frees. And my friends, they weren't allowed to sing songs that weren't related to the Bible. They weren't allowed to read anything that wasn't related to the Bible, other than what they had to learn in school. And, you know, my sister had some friends that were cousins of those people when she was younger and at school. And she got invited to have dinner with them one evening. And, you know, there's no TV, there's no stereo, anything. And they said that since it was a very special occasion and they had a guest, they would allow the children to get the piano out so that they could have piano accompaniment to their hymns. And that was like a wild party for them.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, so what you're saying is there's a big spectrum of belief.
Yeah.
Yes. And practice.
Definitely. So I think, though, there is something particular to the British Isles about that ability to kind of just take on characteristics of new faiths as they sort of washed over. And Britain being a country that was continually invaded since time immemorial by various peoples, it's good that they all managed to sort of cooperate and synchronize with each other for the most part and just sort of take on aspects of whatever the new people coming in.
Mm-hmm. On that note, should we get back to the chapter?
maybe so. So Clamy and Jer. I promise I haven't drunk anything yet.
I just kind of like Clamy.
That's the Brangelina of Outland.
Oh, Lord, no. Please don't ship them. I mean, I guess they are shipped.
I ship
them
pretty hard, so.
We all ship them.
Oh, no. Oh my God.
Well, Diana shipped them a long time ago, girl. So Jamie says to Claire that the tenants will be coming to pay their respects to the new Lady Lallybuck. And I thought, well, of course, he's the laird, she's the lady, but it's my first reading those words for the first time. It kind of hits you over the head like, oh, that's right, Claire's a lady. And I kind of want to snicker into my armpit because that's just not...
Yeah.
She's doing it. Well, I guess you can't really reach it. You can go into your elbow pit or something. I don't know. So Claire says that she'd wondered why he'd remained a virgin for so long, and he said it was mostly because of his father. His mother died when his younger brother was being born, correct? Wasn't Jamie like 6 or something? I mean, I think he has memory of his mother, but she was definitely not the major influence of his life.
Yeah.
You could also see why he would have such a strong influence on Jamie, because that was his sole parent for so long. And so maybe even because of him not having a mother growing up, he pretty much, with his words, to put it in a kind of crass way, beat it into Jamie, not literally, beat it into his head that you need to be respectful and responsible, and unless you are prepared to be responsible for any child, that you conceived with a woman. You have to be prepared to be responsible for the child and also take the woman and protect her. Unless you were prepared to do all of that, you have no right to burden a woman with potential consequences, whether it was dying in childbirth or having, you know, to live on her own and have to raise a child, whatever it may be. And Claire remarks that it would have been rather hard on him then. But Jamie says, while the church teaches that it's a sin to abuse oneself, his father always said he thought it would be better to take that upon oneself than to abuse some poor woman. And I thought, you know, that's the first mention of that.
The first mention of flying solo is what.
There you go. I like that. And you know what that makes me think of?
What?
Flying solo. Yeah. Do you know that musical? Oh, yes. Okay. Anyway.
And here I was just thinking onanism, but there's no song for that.
No.
No.
Just a quick correction. Diane quickly reread, and Jamie was 4.
Oh, Lord.
And it looks it was Willie.
He was 8 when he had his first kiss, which is...
Oh, that's right. And we're coming up on that. Yes. Okay.
A quick side story. Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
His mom left the family when he was very, very young. His parents had never really had a happy marriage, and when his dad came back from the war, his mom had pretty much already shacked up with someone else and just kind of left and went, here's the kids. And years later, when he was starting to get quite famous and really selling out a lot of shows and stuff, a woman came up to him at the end of the show and basically introduced herself as his mom. And he talks about giving her a hug and kind of all the things he wanted to say and all of that, but giving her a hug and having this moment where he smelled her and he was like, oh yeah, that's my mom. And he barely had any other memories of her, but this one thing kind of stuck in the back of his brain. And I imagine a lot of Jamie's memories as being kind of like that, where it's just sort of flashes, where it's something very, very sensory.
It does not surprise me at all that you mentioned the smell, because, of course, sense memory is one of our strongest ones. And the olfactory bulb is one of the closest senses to our brain. That's why aromatherapy is so potentially effective.
Well, Dan bought some Lure Blue.
Oh, yeah?
And for weeks, she kept wearing it, and I was walking around, husband, like, you smell like something. What is that you smell like? And finally, I remembered it smelled similar to something that I smelled when I was, like, a teenager.
You probably had some old maiden aunt who wore it or something. Willie died when he was 8, and Jamie was a few years younger than him. And then his mom died shortly after that. So we could guess that he was probably,
he could have been between 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jamie talks about his time at Dougal's and Dougal's Daughters and his first kiss with Tibby. Tabitha.
God. This whole scene has me like in stitches every time you read it.
I know. In one chapter, even though the events were years apart, in one chapter, Jamie has his bits grabbed twice. And that's just not very fun. Or maybe 3 times. We don't know what Claire did to him. So how they've been caught, meaning Tabitha and himself, how they've been caught practicing kissing by Tabitha's mother, Dougal's wife, and nothing happened, so he thought. And then the next morning, Jamie woke up with Dougal's hands on his bits. And I had to write this down word for word, because this might be where you were laughing, because this made me laugh. So Dougal was asking him questions like, you'll do this, right? You will no longer do this, right? Different things. And so Jamie says, so I said, yes, uncle, and no, uncle. And when he left, I rolled myself up in the quilt and dreamed about pigs. That's safe.
That is a good safe subject. That's got to be the Scottish equivalent of, like, think about baseball.
Yeah, there you go. So Claire tells Jamie of her first kiss at age 8, and he calls her a Jezebel. And we find out that she was in Egypt when it happened, and the boy she kissed was 9. So she's always, well, except for Jamie, she's always kind of gone for the slightly older man. And as they're getting closer to the mill, and she admires it. But before they go down to it, Jamie pulls Claire into the trees, and there's another well-known line from the book. He tells her, you weren't the first last I kissed, but I swear you'll be the last.
Aww.
And that's, I know, and everybody go, aww.
And everyone who's read the series, the last.
We haven't gotten to his last kiss yet.
I know, I'm just
there's
saying.
There's some other ones in the mix.
There's more in between. She was not like.
He didn't say he'll never kiss anybody else. He said he'll be my last. So we just hope Diana keeps it to that. So Jamie talks to the miller, and then when they talk about what's going on or what the problem might be, and then he decides that he's going to have to go into the pond, into the base of the mill, I guess, the base of the
water wheel.
The
under the water wheel, there's something stuck.
The wheel, yeah.
or not the wheel, well, the base of under the water, whatever that
in
is, to fix the problem. And he begins to strip, and Claire gasps. This cracks me up. It's like, she's never been particularly shy about things. I mean, usually you would expect Jamie to gasp if she were to start disrobing. And here he is, and she's freaking out, like, what?
She wasn't gasping about him taking
his clothes off. I understand that. But then when you read on, we find out that he's got a short garment of incredible elderliness, originally of red flannel, now patched with a dazzling array of colors and
like Joseph's coat of many colors.
I know. Jamie's drawers of many colors. And they hung precariously from his hip bones. And then I think the best part is when he gets in the water, or he's going to it, and this is a quote, with considerable dignity, he gathered the excess material up in one hand and waded into the mill pond. And how low does this thing hang? Is it like weighing 3 pounds or something? What is this?
I just imagine these sad, droopy, inherited underwear just floating around his knees. Poor thing.
As soon as you say inherited underwear, I immediately got like a movie from head to toe.
I just love that Claire looks at him and says, "Your grandfather's."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and he acts a little bit offended by the whole thing.
That's one of my favorite Jamie attitudes, is when he's doing something humiliated, and he gets even more snooty, and I can't believe you would laugh at me.
Exactly.
Like,
so Jamie is doing, this is of course my words, so Jamie's doing the water dance. He's coming up, he's coming up to say to the miller and for air, and then he's going back down to try and fiddle with it again. And Claire's digging in the water plants. I thought that was very much Claire, not one to lose an opportunity. And an old woman comes up behind her, and we learn it's Granny McNabb. And she gives Claire some tips as to some of the plants she's picked. One is kind of, maybe not deadly poisonous, but can definitely give you the runs or give you bowel issues. And she also gives her very, and I think Scott seemed to be, at least in the book, very direct.
Yes.
And she's like, yeah, you don't look so thick. Here's some help on having babies, making babies. And didn't she say I wrote that down. She had 13 children and raised 10 of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Quite an accomplishment.
So Claire, excuse me.
Claymie.
So Claymie. Oh, Lord. So, yeah, so she's like, look, I've had this many kids, and I'm telling you, drinking raspberry leaf tea is gonna be the thing for you. But she also has a favor to ask, and it comes down to one of her grandsons, Ravi, as opposed to Robert or Bob, is being beaten by his father, and she wants Jamie to take him on at the big house as a stable boy. And she mentions that her own husband hadn't laid a finger on her after the first time. And I think, oh, so Granny McNabb is along the lines of Claire. She
takes objection to
being
beaten.
Yeah, she's like, not over my not so dead body.
Exactly.
And while Granny is chatting with Claire, her face freezes, and Claire knows something is wrong, and she looks and she sees some redcoats coming, some dragoons. And this is something that this is one of those things that you pick up on, or you don't, but on a new reread. I don't remember, maybe I knew before, but I didn't remember, Granny McNabb just do-do-do-do-do-do stands up, goes over to where Jamie's clothes are, and sits down, effectively hiding them. I totally missed that.
I really was impressed with her presence of mind. Like, she had about 30 seconds to figure out what to do, and she's like, don't worry, you guys, I got this, and completely covers for Jamie and takes care of the whole situation. And I think that's as impressive to me as all of her advice and her baby having, is that this is clearly a very smart, with it old lady.
Mm-hmm. Well, she has to save Jamie, because if not, her grandson's going to keep getting
killed. That's true. She does have a dog in the fight, definitely.
Well, I mean, she's wily. Like, I mean, the fact that she comes up and gives Claire this advice on how to have babies and stuff, it's almost a transaction. You know, she's come up and, hey, here's what I'm offering you. Now I need a favor.
How Scottish.
And I just, very smart of her. She's someone who thinks these things out in advance, and she's fast.
She knew when she was coming down to ask for, and she knew also that to ensure it, it was obviously, as we said, in her best interest to make sure that the laird and lady stayed alive. So Jamie
bursts out of the water, sees the soldiers, and or Claire believes so, because all she hears is him coming out of the water, a beat, and then a little mouth. And then he goes underneath, he goes back under the water. And I always wonder how long, when we're reading this, I always wondered, oh my gosh, did he like hold his breath the entire time? But then I read somewhere in the chapter, there's a reference to,
there may be
a little air underneath the mill house.
Yeah, like where the workings are, that there's like a place where he can come up and stay hidden.
Okay, so I thought, well, thank God, because I think the very first time I read it, I thought he held his breath, and I thought, there's no way.
He's gonna die. Yeah, I feel myself every time I read this part holding my breath while this stuff is going on, because you can just imagine Jamie under the water, freezing, not waiting, not knowing if he's safe to come out. And
reading on, I was, because they were not mean in any way, but reading on about how the Redcoats were just like insistent of, oh, what's wrong? Oh, let us help. Oh, let us help. Oh, what's wrong? Let us help. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys. So I understand that they are occupiers, and this does not necessarily give them a bad face at all. Mm-hmm. This is a positive thing. Right. They're there. They're trying to help. But obviously we know it would be bad for Jamie if he was discovered. But aside from Jamie being there, they would have helped with the mill. I'm not conflicted about them being there because they need to get gone because of Jamie. But I'm kind of conflicted about how I feel about them, because we're seeing so much about, you know, Randall bad, Redcoats bad, yet here they are. Yes, they're occupiers, but they seem genuinely interested to help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You see this in modern conflicts, too, that if you're an occupier, it's in your best interest if the locals don't hate your guts. And
absolutely.
And I'm sure they benefit from this mill, too, because they need grain to make into flour to eat as well. So, yeah, it's definitely them trying to do a good deed, but I'm sure they're also out there to kind of keep an eye on what's going on. Obviously, if the police are on patrol and they see that your cat's in a tree, they're going to come and help you with it. They're also going to make sure you don't have, like, a gun in your pocket, so.
Exactly. And then, of course, a few lines later, the Redcoats are awfully inquisitive. They seem very keen, but they did also, they came begging for, I think, a bag of wheat. Mm. And then they're told the mill's not quite working, and then they go to inspect it, and then all of this. Granny had looked at Claire for a moment and mimed her before they actually made their way down to be quiet so as not to give herself away as an Englishwoman. So, yeah, Granny McNabb she's the savior in this chapter.
She's totally the hero.
She is the huge hero. And she totally I think if it were in any other circumstances, Claire might want to bop her over the head, but seeing as for what she says about her, but seeing as how she's saving her life, Claire's like, yeah, and it wasn't too hard for me to act like I was a little bit gone.
And so
Granny totally, totally saves the day, and she says that Claire isn't right in the head since her babe was stillborn, and so it is genius for her to think of that so quickly, and also to get Claire not to speak and give herself away, but also because when the men hear this, they kind of change, like, oh, yeah, maybe we don't want to go down there.
I don't know about that.
But if she'd spoken, they would have known she was English. And
obviously.
That would have brought more questions than
and they
having
would have
an English woman.
Longer, yeah.
Would have thrown them out.
It would have totally.
Mm-hmm. They would have had a lot more questions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, one thing I like in this chapter is there is very much Scots to this day, we remember.
Yes, you do.
There's sort of an understanding that it's not all English. It's the Southern English, specifically the ones in big cities. Mm. So, like, you know, I had a great uncle who was a Yorkshireman. And you did not call him an Englishman. He was not English. He was a Yorkshireman. And so there's kind of an understanding that, you know, there's England and there's England. And one of the things I liked in this chapter was it was sort of like, from a Scottish perspective, well, he was an okay English soldier because he was from the countryside. You know, he wasn't a soft southern city boy. And those ones are the ones you have to worry about. And so that was one of the things I liked in this chapter, was kind of seeing that, like, you know, the times you get to see the nice English people, it tends to be the ones that are more countrified.
Could, like, salt of the earth kind of
people. Yeah.
But that's true. Could you imagine someone, I mean, besides the fact that he's a sadist and all that stuff, Could you imagine someone as citified or as proper, whatever you want to call it, as Randall at any age offering to disrobe and go into a pond? I don't think so.
Yeah. To help some Scottish peasant.
Exactly. Not just, yeah, exactly. To help a Scottish family. Even if, yes, you hope to get wheat out of it. He still didn't have to, you know, offer to help. So that was intriguing to me. And I'm glad you brought that up, that there was English and there was English. That, again, is something that was a choice that Diana made in her writing. It could have been, you know, especially as an American and not as someone who is, you know, Scottish and who has grown up reading or being inquisitive about Scottish history or even British history until I was in my teens. The American view of English as far as historically is red coat, and of course our own history. So with that background, which is very black and white, I know there's layers and gray to everything. Mm-hmm. Looking at it though from that very basic background, and looking at it, people at a mill trying to hide from the English, and then the English soldiers show up, looking at it from that kind of background, thinking, oh, you know, red coat bad, other person good, and here they are, they show up, and you think, oh my gosh, you know, it is right thus far in this story, then you could understand that the characters should be and were scared of them showing up.
Right.
But yes, you're right. And hearing what you said reminds me that Diana makes such choices, but it's not just the storytelling and the research of things, it's the thought that goes into showing different types of quote-unquote bad guys.
Right. It would have been very easy to make them just another, like, mustache.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The choice to show that these are three-dimensional characters rather than just archetypes is, you know, that's one of the things that I like about her writing, is that she doesn't just go, okay, a Highlander acts like this, a damsel in distress acts like this, an English soldier acts like this. They're people, and they have more character to them than that.
And so the gentleman is just about ready to say that he'll go into the pond and see what's wrong. And, of course, there's no way for Jamie to hide with someone going down there who could potentially see him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Claire is, like, just getting ready to, and this made me laugh, Claire is on the verge of throwing an epileptic fit when the wheel starts to move. One of the redcoats says, I wonder what was stuck in it. And I wrote down, and on cue, Jamie's sodden red drawers floated to the top of the water.
This is one of my favorite moments. I know.
There has to be, like, a few beats in there of just silence, and I hope that they get the looks on all the faces.
I really want this scene to be in the show. I think this would be an amazing moment. And for a serious, mostly dark story, they are going to need some light moments. So I definitely hope this scene is in there. And his sad, droopy drawers floating to the water. And I would love to see the look on Claire's face at that moment where she's going, oh no, now what do I do?
Well, none of that. And then He keeps them as a souvenir, and I had totally forgotten that part. He's like, huh, well, and he, like, uses them to, like, what, wipe mud off of his boots or something,
yeah.
and he just ends up keeping them, and I'm like, well, then.
Like, from gun cleaning or
not just was it interesting, right, like, you know, if something, some weird kind of fabric floated up to the top of something and whatever, and you were in a place you'd never been, would you want, well, today, with today's hygiene, totally different, I get it, I wouldn't want to touch someone's floaty drawers, but...
Well, they've been in the water. They're clean.
Barely. Well, he doesn't know that they've only been into there for, like, 3 seconds,
right.
But they've also been on a man's bit, so no.
Let's be fair. Would you guys jump at the chance to own something that had been rubbing on Jamie's crotch?
then these guys going, okay, it's a flannel, piece of flannel we can use
exactly.
with, and he even says something of a souvenir.
Exactly. But the cool thing is this actually reflects or ties in with our conversation with Diane, or all of us, but speaking with Diane about the wool, but how fine, well, probably, I guess, how fine of a piece of fabric it was, but also that how coveted fabric itself was and how it wasn't easy to come across.
Right, right. And just that at that stage, it still would have been that for that flannel to happen, someone's hands would have carded and spun that wool and woven it, or whatever, linen or whatever fabric it was, and woven it into a garment. And they just had a very different conception of the usefulness of fabric and and how it was to be treated, and nothing would have been wasted as far as that goes. So.
Well, and, you know, it's not precisely an Outlander example, but, you know, Dan and I do medieval reenactment, and on one of the email lists we were on for our group, there's a call out right now because someone needs to stuff their Elizabethan bum roll. And there's a call out for anyone's scrap wool because it's going to take a lot.
And it needs to be wool specifically for that. So, yeah, I mean, and it also kind of makes it a little bit more sensible why Jamie would have kept his father's droopy red flannel drawers. That,
of course,
you know, I mean, other than the sentimental value, which I don't know if you really would have sentimental value about something like that, but that it would have been, you know, it was still good. It was still some use in it, and so Jamie was going to hang on to it. And like a good Scotsman, he knew that if he was going to be, if there was any chance that his bits were going to be seen, he would darn well wear something under his kilt, because that's what a gentleman would do. So,
yes,
thank goodness he was prepared. Except when he came out of the water at the very end, and he's sitting there shivering.
Exactly. As the soldiers leave, Jamie rises from the depths of the pond, and Diana's words, the resident water sprite. I love it. Because he's so not a sprite. But I love it. As Granny was there, and Jamie couldn't leave the pond, or he sees her, and he's like, and he stops. And she had wanted to speak with him. She doesn't even finish her request. Jamie says, yes, anything you want, it's a yes. Just give me my shirt. I want to get out of here. It's cold. My parts are going to fall off. So here we've talked about, obviously, a chapter. We talked about how Claire feels like, and Jamie, too, I'm sure. They feel like it's her first time she's felt at home, probably maybe ever. And she's still fresh-ish coming off of her decision to stay here and at this time with him and meeting his sister and his brother-in-law, now her own sister and brother-in-law, some of the tenants, and then going and just getting along with the life of the estate and,
just having to,
you know, going on to help out.
Down roots and
exactly, and knowing that they couldn't at least now. And so, yeah, so I agree with you. It's a very poignant chapter. It's comical, of course. And Granny saves the day.
She's great. I sure hope that
I like her
make an appearance in the chapter. And I think that's a good illustration of a tough Scottish woman. My ancestors came to Idaho from Scotland, and it was a mother and her, I think, 6 grown children and all of their spouses and children. And you just have to imagine that she would have been in her 70s, and that she somehow got all of these people together, and they all came and immigrated to a completely, like, parts unknown. And I just think, what a woman she must have been to, I don't know if she would have been quite on Granny McNabb's caliber, but to get all of them all together and drag them halfway across the world to a very complicated and not very pleasant life for a very long time.
The interesting part that Dan's leaving out is they lived in a hole in the ground underneath a hill
for a year. They lived in a dugout house for several years while they were getting the money together to build a real house. But, yeah, they came from Kirkcaldy, from Fife area, and emigrated to Idaho. And the second house built in the state of Idaho, like the actual second house.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was this giant family that all just traipsed over here together. So, I don't know, those tough old Scottish biddies, they did get things done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you again so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Last night, that my young